Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Not sure that we have a quorum yet, but Representative Hillstrom, you can present your bill, and when we have a quorum, we will then have you move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have House File 1353, and this came out of a collaboration that's going on currently between the Sheriff's Department and my two cities, Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park. And with me is Rich Sanek from the New Hennepin County Sheriff, the Police Chief of the City of Brooklyn Park, Wade Setter, and the Police Chief of the City of Brooklyn Center, Scott Bechtel. I do need to make an amendment, a oral amendment, when we have a quorum, because the Senate changed the appropriation in each line to $1 million. It's currently at $750,000, and I'd be happy to amend the dollar amount upwards to match the Senate.
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to have your presenters discuss the bill since we do have a quorum now? Right?
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Then, we have a quorum? We have a quorum. Representative Hillstrom, you want to move your bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1353 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus public safety bill.
Okay, and now do you want to offer your amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that on line 1.6, $750,000 be appropriate or be scratched in both places on that line, and in their place insert $1 million in both places.
Okay, so Representative Hillstrom moves to delete $750,000 on line 6 in both, twice in that line for fiscal year 08 and 09, and insert $1 million in on line 6 for 08 and 09. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails.
All right. Thank
Very
you.
Very good, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to turn it over to the New Hennepin County Sheriff, Rich Sanek.
Sheriff Sanek, welcome to the committee and congratulations on your election.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is Rich Sanek. I'm the Hennepin County Sheriff. It's great to be back in front of your committee, Mr. Chair. You've got a lot of great members, and I know you've got a lot of work to do this session, so we'll keep it brief and to the point just the way I know you like it. Mr. Chair, members, you know, in talking with Representative Hillstrom, I really commend her leadership for bringing this legislation forward. This is an important endeavor for the folks in Hennepin County, as well as the cities of Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and the other 40-plus cities that comprise Hennepin County. We're here to discuss the formation of the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force. This task force, Mr. Chair, members, I'm pleased to say, is really a multi-agency collaborative partnership, including Mike Freeman in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Tim Dolan, the Chief of Police in Minneapolis, the ATF, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, Rachel Pelosi, Chief Setter, obviously, Chief Bechtold, and a number of other organizations or law enforcement agencies throughout our county. As you know, Mr. Chair, members, violent crime continues to increase, not just across our core cities, but Hennepin County and statewide. I brought a couple of graphs this morning that were put together over the last several weeks, and I think that Chief Setter will touch on this first one off to our left. But you can see, just looking at the graph itself, how violent crime has increased in the number of our core cities as well as the suburbs across Hennepin County fairly dramatically, I might add. Mr. Chair, members, murder, robbery, shootings, you know, they're on the front page of the Star Tribune, the Pioneer Press, the local community newspapers every day, 5, 6, 9, 10 o'clock newscasts. 45% of all violent crime that occur in the state of Minnesota occur in Hennepin County. You also know, Mr. Chair, members, that crime is a regional problem. I've heard you folks talk about this before. It's absolutely true. We've had meetings with mayors and police chiefs, criminal justice practitioners throughout the county, even outside of our county, to talk about the changing demographics and the trends and what we can do as a law enforcement or a criminal justice community as a whole to try and curtail it and make it go back down to the levels that they were. No level is acceptable, Mr. Chair, as you know, but again, our job is cut out for us, and with endeavors like the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force, we think we can make a significant difference. Criminals don't recognize borders and jurisdictions, but we know that law enforcement must, and thus the need for a countywide effort. This task force really builds upon the successful model that Chief Dolan and the Minneapolis Police Department use. When I was a Minneapolis police officer, we started this endeavor about 18 to 20 months ago. We had staggering results, and I'm just going to quote you a couple of them after about 18 to 20 months of operation. We arrested 246 violent offenders, obtained 91 federal indictments, 12 murder indictments, 46 felony-level state charges. We recovered 130 guns, 40 kilos of cocaine, 1,000 kilos of marijuana, and seized over $1.8 million in assets from the bad guys themselves. Those are pretty significant I think, in terms of a successful model that we want to replicate then countywide. I think I'm going to end there. I'm going to turn it over to or back to Representative Hillstrom as we move forward, but I'll be available for questions. I have a couple folks in Hennepin County Sheriff's Office here, including Inspector Mike Carlson, who heads up our Investigations Bureau. He was the architect of the Violent Offender Task Force as a model, and will continue working with our collaborative partners to put this together countywide. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Sheriff. Senator Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I have the Chief of the City of Brooklyn Park, Wade Setter.
Chief Setter, you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Wade Setter, and I'm the police chief in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, and here to talk with you about the Violent Offender Task Force, which Sheriff Stanek recently described. What is interesting to us in looking at violent crime over the last couple of years in Brooklyn Park, for example, between 1999 and 2004, we actually saw a 16.5% overall reduction in crime rates. Starting in 2005, we started seeing some alarming increases, about a 5% overall increase in crime rate. In 2006, we believe that increase will be 5 to 8%. That doesn't tell the whole story, however. In 2003, the FBI started tracking, as a part of the Uniform Crime Report, violent crime offenses as a separate entity. Murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, clearly the worst crimes against persons that plague our communities. Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center have very similar demographics and had similar experiences. For example, in 2006 in Brooklyn Park, we saw a 92% increase in robberies. We went from 83 robberies to 158, so it's not small numbers in a community of about 72,000 people. Brooklyn Center saw a 50% increase in that same time. As recently as 2 weeks ago, our city, through our city manager and mayor, convened a collaborative meeting, a crime summit, if you will, consisting of mayors, city managers, and police chiefs from about 20 communities in the north suburban area, not just in Hennepin County, but Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Columbia Heights, Fridley, Hopkins, for example, is one of the other suburbs in our county that is seeing some significant increases. We don't have a universal problem with regard to increases in violent crime. It's sporadic. It tends to be situated on the north suburban area. Certainly, we believe that a lot of the increases in Minneapolis's crime are on the north side and certainly impact our communities. This is a huge issue for us. We have had 3 homicides in the last 6 months, all of them gun crimes. One was a drug ripoff where the 2 individuals shot and killed a young man over a quarter ounce of marijuana, about $100 worth of marijuana. Another one was a domestic situation where an old boyfriend, shot and killed, ambushed and shot and killed a new boyfriend. The telling tale behind that particular story, though, is the individual that we ultimately arrested is from Detroit, is a gang member, and came to Minneapolis from Detroit, to Brooklyn Park, actually, with the express purpose of executing this gang. As recently as a month ago, you may have seen some media attention to a double homicide that we had in our community. I can tell you it's in the central part of our community, an apartment neighborhood, again, a domestic situation, but what the story doesn't tell you is a fully automatic AK-47 was used. It was a gang hit, an unsanctioned gang hit by 2 gangster disciples, and ultimately we spent just in our community alone over $50,000 in overtime in an effort to fully investigate that case. We have 2 of the 3 suspects charged. Through the assistance of an extensive working relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, Sheriff Stanek provided us with 4 detectives to assist us with that case. We are still working on it today, and you can imagine the type of violence that's occurring and the impact that has on a suburban community. The effort that Sheriff Stranix described is an extension and expansion of a very successful effort with the Minneapolis Police Department, and it's designed to target the worst of the worst, the real bad guys in our communities that are doing the types of things I just described to you, and to put them in prison for a long time. And we are convinced that the model has works well in Minneapolis. We're convinced it can work well in our communities, and we think it's absolutely essential in order to save our communities from a further degradation and increase in violent crime. So with that, I would turn it back over to Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you for your testimony, Chief Representative Hillstrom.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final testifier is Scott Bechtel, the police chief for the City of Brooklyn Center. And I hope he will show you on the chart where Brooklyn Center now falls. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott Bechtel, Chief of Police for the City of Brooklyn Center. As you can see, the City of Brooklyn Center has risen above even the City of Minneapolis in the rise of crime in the past few years. Last week I gave testimony as far as the decrease in crime and what affected the decrease in crime in the 90s, and now as a result of the cuts in funding at the federal and state level, crime is back on the rise. But what is worrisome here is it's violent crime. It's homicides, it's aggravated assaults, and it's robberies. 2 years ago, we noticed an increase in our robberies, unorganized, informal gangs of young men targeting different variety of victims. But now what we're seeing is that it's getting worse. 1 month ago, a robbery resulted in the homicide of a cab driver in our city, and we're taking more guns off the street as we target our robbery through our robbery initiatives. I think the sheriff and Chief Setter pretty much covered the bases on this topic, but I want to say this initiative and the collaborative of this initiative with the members that will belong to it will quit displacing crime. This is surgery aimed at stopping crime and putting the worst of the worst back at where they belong, in jail, in prison.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was first elected to the City Council 12 years ago, crime was the number one issue in my community. And then the Clinton cops came, and we saw a dramatic decline in crime, and pretty soon my constituents were back to focusing on things about the community rather than about crime. The murder that took place with the cab driver was 2 blocks from my home. Everyone is talking about crime in my community. It is back to being number one in terms of constituent contacts that I receive. So if this committee would be so indulgent and consider allowing us the resources we need to do this violent crimes task force, I believe that it will have significant impact, not just within Hennepin County, but in the outer areas as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. We have some questions. Representative Cornish.
Sheriff, or anybody that wants to answer it, how would you use the funds as far as like FTEs or more cops, or would you work the existing forces of all the departments and augment them in more of a leadership and coordination than you would actually putting more people on the street? And secondly, could you give me some assurance that if you get the funding, you'll concentrate on crime and criminals and not guns, and not have any of those silly $50 buy gun programs?
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Cornish, thank you for that question. Kind of a two-part question. I'll answer the latter first. And that is that, this initiative, the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force, is aimed to reduce guns, gangs, kids, and drugs. Now, those are the four components of violent crime. You know what violent crime is made up of, as Chief Bechtel laid out, murder, robbery, homicide, rape, aggravated assault. That's the violent crime categories. So this is targeted at the offenders themselves, not necessarily the tools they do to commit their heinous offenses in our communities. In terms of how we would use the legislative appropriation, it would supplement personnel, meaning a large portion of the funding would go to local agencies to be able to place an investigator, and we're looking for investigators, detectives, with the task force so that they can go after these individuals. It may be some type of salary offset. Many of these agencies or communities You know, they run in budget streams depending on how the agency is. But this is an initiative that's outside of the regular budgeting process at this point. And so what we've asked for is essentially pilot money, seed money to get it started. Get it started countywide. If this task force is successful, Representative Cornish and members, Mr. Chair, this task force should be funding itself through the asset forfeitures and seizures that the task force takes from the bad guys themselves in the out years. That's our goal. That's what I talked about earlier, in about 18 to 20 months of operation, seizing $1.8 million in monies and assets from the bad guys, and then using that back to continue to fund the task force and our law enforcement and prevention efforts aimed at violent offenders throughout Hennepin County.
Representative Cornish.
And just to comment, Mr. Chair, just to show you that these programs really work, my son, the state trooper, went down to downtown Minneapolis, part of that group down there, and they made a real difference, a cut in crime. And while he was down there, they're walking down the street with a Minneapolis copper, and a gangbanger comes up to him and going to walk right by him, and all of a sudden stops and spits right on their shoes. And so they shake him down. He's got drugs on him. The idiot would have just walked right by him. But so they noticed a difference while they were there, and that type of people getting off the street and their presence, and so in their coordination with the rest of the police force. So these operations, I think, really do work.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Chair Stanek, thank you for your testimony. You did answer one of my questions, and that is had to do with whether or not this would have to be rolled into the base funding. But it does sound like you do have a plan to wean yourself off of the state dole in bringing this forward. I do have one other question, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Representative Hillstrom or Sheriff Stanek. Did Minneapolis receive a state grant to create the model that you are going to replicate, or did they do that with their own internal funds?
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Biskins, Minneapolis did not. The collaborative effort, theoretically, this task force, Hennepin County-wide, would be composed of 20 or 21 law enforcement officers. Hennepin County would put in 7. Minneapolis has 7 working with their unit now. The FBI, the ATF would contribute a couple agents. Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, and or other agencies throughout Hennepin County are welcome to do that. We've had discussions as late as yesterday afternoon with 4 other cities within Hennepin County that want to participate, can't do it at this point because of financial reasons, are looking for something like this from the legislature to help give them that incentive to get it started so that we can start to turn things around. And that's how the appropriation would be used. That's how we look at it in terms of staffing. But the short answer to your question, again, is Minneapolis did not. They've got a fairly large agency of well over 800 officers, and it was a unit within the agency itself in collaboration with the federal partners to do this. We're proposing twice the size, more than twice the area or countywide. There's a lot of bad guys out there that we can go after, as you see in the graph behind you, and that's what we aim to do.
Representative Smith.
Chairman, thank you. I just have one or maybe 2 questions, Sheriff and Chiefs, and I want to be brief because I'd like the 3 of you to not be delayed here and get back to where you belong to keep these evil people off my streets, so I'll be very brief. On that chart up there where it shows 2002-2005 violent crime was, and then you got 484 per 100,000 in 2002, and the number is dramatically up in 2005. So this bill passes, becomes part of the omnibus bill. You get the money for this worthy goal that I think is before us. So you come back here in a couple years, the next time we're doing the budget, and you bring the chart back. What is 2008 going to show me? What's the number going to be on violent crime was?
Chief Sutter.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I noticed Sheriff Stanek handed off the that question to me. I think, you know, the answer, to be quite frank with you, is we don't know. Certainly we're hopeful it will be dramatically reduced. I can tell you that over the last 8 months, I've spent a good deal of my time as a police chief trying to develop a budget and a plan and a strategy to respond to this, not only from a law enforcement perspective, but it is a community-wide perspective, and it's community throughout the Twin Cities area. I think what we do know is last October, the Police Executive Research Forum, which is a professional association of police executives around the country, convened a crime summit in Washington, D.C. to discuss this issue. Chief Dolan and Mayor Rybeck attended, and the report that was produced identified a couple of things. Number one, there is a phenomenon of a significant increases in violent crime throughout the country. This is a problem. It is not universal. The problems in Brooklyn Park are not being experienced necessarily in Edina or even Bloomington to the same degree. But we do know that there is a younger generation of males in this country who are committing violent offenses, frequently with weapons, and are doing really bad things in our community, and we are seeing that every single day. My goal would be, certainly, if we could say in 2 years it's going to take this issue to get this up and running, that's a it takes time to get people experience and so forth. I think conceivably we'd like to see a 50% reduction. But, you know, there are other issues at that. Crime is not just a law enforcement problem, it's a social problem. And the other social responses at some point do need to come forward here. Minnesota has one of the lowest rates of incarceration in the country. That, I think, is a problem. We are seeing offenders that are, I can tell you a story last August. We had a young man, one of my sergeants, sees him. He looks like a robbery suspect. He encounters him, stops him. The guy ends up turning and running. They wrestle. Fortunately, a security guard came out of Aldi's grocery store to assist the sergeant because the young man, who's 19 years old, had his hand in his pocket and had a loaded .32 caliber revolver in there, along with some crack cocaine and some marijuana. There is no doubt in my mind he was trying to kill that police officer. That is happening every day. The tragedy of that is this individual, this bad guy, had a presumptive sentence of 60 months under sentencing guidelines and went to trial, or did not go to trial, but entered a plea. The court accepted the plea and gave him a year in the workhouse, a downward departure over the objection of the state. So the problems are not just law enforcement problems, they're criminal justice problems, they're community problems, and we all need to work together. I think this is a significant step towards taking those guys and making sure we build the good cases that can put them in prison for the 60 months rather than exercising you know, some of the other discretion that's exercised.
Mr. Chairman, Sheriff, I mean Chief, thank you. So I heard, you know, nobody's going to, on this panel, on this committee, or in your job, they're going to win or lose an election by giving me a number. And I'm really on your side, and I think that the evil people that you've described, they should be caught, given a trial, make sure it's fair, and then put somewhere for a long time. So I'm interested in what your gut tells you, and if you'll share it with me, what 2008, you get this money, do your work, what is that number going to be? Just what do you think?
Chief Stetter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think it can easily be 30%. I really do believe that. It could be as high as 50% reduction.
Okay.
I sincerely believe that. We've seen a 23% reduction in 2006 over 2005. I know with putting some of the resources we've already redistributed, we've had that effect.
Mr. Chair, members, can I just quick whack at that question? Thank you, Representative Smith. You know, a year ago, April, about 10, 11 months ago, in Minneapolis, violent crime was up approximately 40%, give or take a few percentage points. By the end of the year, they brought the violent crime rate down to, Deputy Chief Allen, 17, 18, 16%, significant increase from 40 down to 16, 17, 18. One of the contributing factors in that was the Minneapolis Violent Offender Task Force. And again, Representative Smith, members, I'll go back to the numbers. There were 246 less violent offenders on the streets of Minneapolis. There were 91 federal indictments. That's 91 more off the streets. 12 murder indictments. 130 guns off the street taken from the bad guys. Not law-abiding citizens, but the bad guys. 40 kilos of cocaine, 1,000 kilos of marijuana, and $1.8 million in illegal proceeds from drug trafficking, gang activity, violent offenses that's less that was on the streets of Minneapolis in a period of time as a result of one of the contributing factors, the Minneapolis Police Violent Offender Task Force. And so if you take that as a snapshot, you apply that to what it's going to look like 24 months from now or 30 months from now when we come back before this committee. Mr. Chair, I hope you do invite us back and ask us to report on our progress. I would certainly expect that, and I think myself and my colleagues would welcome that. We want to tell you what's happening in our communities across this great state. But I think those numbers will start to go down, and you know that I can tell you based on my 23 years of experience and then the chiefs themselves. I think between the three of us, we probably have close to... I only have 23, but between the two of them, they have another 50 or 60 years of experience in law enforcement, criminal justice.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Gentlemen, Sheriff and Chiefs, thanks for coming with this and to the author. It sounds good. I hope we can fully fund this when we get to it. That's all. Thank you, Brett.
We have two more questions, and then we have two more bills also, so I'd like to move on if we could. Representative Murphy's next, and then Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions.
Representative Murphy.
I want to start by saying that my home during the legislative session is in Brooklyn Center. And so I know the area of what you're speaking, but I have a couple questions for Sheriff Stanek. And I don't quite understand what you're talking about. Task force. You're using that title task force. And in a way, that sets up a block in my mind. Is everybody going to have different jackets and travel around in packs and come to the legislature with their jackets on?
No.
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Murphy, thank you again for that question. We can get into great detail about the operational component of the Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force. So let me just touch on a couple for you rather than boring the committee with the intimate details. This task force, again, multi-agency, multi-collaborative. County, local, state, federal, as I mentioned, with ATF, FBI, federal prosecutors, U.S. attorney, we all get together. This Hennepin County Violent Offender Task Force will be governed by a joint powers agreement. Myself and the chiefs sitting down and figuring out the governance structure of it and the operational side of it. This is not unlike what is this five narcotics task forces that operate throughout Hennepin County. There's a metro gang task force that operates within Hennepin County in the metropolitan area as well as statewide. It takes kind of the best of some of those takes the best of those models and replicates it in terms of what we want to do. That's the easiest way to explain it without getting into great detail.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're very good, Sheriff, detecting what I was asking. Guns, kids, gangs, what else?
Guns, yeah. Gangs, kids, and drugs. Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what about the judiciary? When Police Chief Sutter was talking, he talked about the judiciary also. Are they not going to be part of this at all?
Sheriff Stanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Murphy, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office is a member of this task force in terms of giving us advice and guidance. They're the ones that wrote the joint powers agreement for the task force that we're going to operate under and be governed by. The judiciary itself, in the pure sense, like the Hennepin County bench, I've had discussions with the chief judge and some of the other judges throughout the county. But again, this is a law enforcement initiative targeted at violent offenders on the streets. The rest of the criminal justice system comes into play. You should also know, Representative Murphy and members, the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, which is the overarching kind of governance structure for criminal justice within Hennepin County, supports this, approved it as part of their legislative agenda as well. And we're very pleased by that because that recognizes that it's a countywide problem and countywide resources, countywide initiative to get the job done.
Representative Murphy.
Two more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, you don't want to, we don't need to go into the details, but do you have the details in concept and in, could you share that with us and tell us how you're going to report to the legislature? You said we could invite you back, but I would expect that you are going to prepare a yearly report and share that with us. And then accountability. How can we measure your accountability?
Sheriff Stanek.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Murphy. A couple of things. One, I don't believe the legislative language talks about a report back to the legislature. But again, I would welcome coming back to the legislature with my colleagues or whatever format you would like. We'd like to tell you about the progress we make in terms of our efforts. Secondly, I'm confident that we are working out the details of the operational side as well as the joint powers agreement. Again, I think the joint powers agreement is pretty much done. It's gone out to the local chiefs in the county for approval so they can move it through their individual councils or our county board.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chairman, finally. Okay, so everything's in place. You've received the money. Everything's in place. Everybody's cooperating. You're making success. 6-7 months down the line, something happens, and one of the key players is replaced. You find that you have to replace one of the key players. How is that going to be addressed so that all the fans of the key player that has to be replaced aren't on our doorstep?
Sheriff Stanek.
And saying, oh my goodness, this is what happened, and this is wrong, and this isn't what you intended.
Sheriff Stanek.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Murphy, I guess there's two ways to answer that. I'll take the path of least resistance. If those key players are the bad guys who are committing the murders out in these cities and the robberies and the shootings and the stabbings, well, then I'm happy to keep replacing them on our who we go after.
No, key, if you're talking about personnel, key players in your task force. Yes.
If you're talking about personnel, again, the governance structure through the Joint Powers Agreement would dictate that. I know from the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office side, we have sent 7 very experienced detectives, folks who have been doing this for a lot of years. I know Minneapolis as well, and I assume that these agencies will send good quality investigators that can get the job done. Will there always be different nuances or problems in terms of that piece of it? I'm confident that we can work this out between us as law enforcement professionals, and I don't anticipate those problems at this point.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A real brief question. This will help my day job, so I'm really excited about this task force. The question I have is, Sheriff Stanek, you mentioned that it's guns, gangs, drugs, and kids. And we do have a drug task force, and we do have a gang task force. So I'm just wondering, are there any plans to work together or maybe corroborate on different things?
Chief Sutter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, coincidentally, I chair the Minnesota Gang and Drug Oversight Council, and I have investigators, 2 investigators assigned to a drug task force. I also have an investigator assigned to the Metro Gang Strike Force, as do most of my colleagues. Our intention, and clearly the direction to our investigators assigned to this group, is to collaborate with those. We're not trying to supplant. We're not trying to replace. We think it's complementary. Certainly, as the sheriff described the Minneapolis experience, it's inevitable that we will be involved in drug investigations, and I would fully expect that the VOTF, the Violent Offenders Task Force, will coordinate those investigations with the narcotics investigators in the appropriate jurisdictions, as well as with the Gang Strike Force. We are very clear, and I think being very cautious, as managers, not to create a redundant effort. We recognize that, and each one of those that you described, the Gang Strike Force, the drug task forces, have a very distinct and a very important function in our communities. So we are working through that.
Representative Hilston, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this bill is very important to my community. Violent crime has become the number one priority of my district, and I hope that we stop displacing it and we actually start fighting it, and I would encourage your support.
Representative Hilstrom, I just want to make one comment. I think everybody is sympathetic and appreciates what you're trying to do here, the crime in the West Metro. I mean, it's... You're seeing it every day, and something needs to be done. I'm mindful of the fact that the governor is recommending $600,000 this year and $1.9 million in fiscal year in 08 and fiscal year 09 for the gang and drug task force on top of the $3.8 million on the base budget. And now you're asking us to create another task force, and I can imagine that my sheriff, Bob Fletcher, will be in here next year asking for a Ramsey County task force. And at some point, I think this committee needs to think through how we're providing law enforcement and criminal how we're intervening to stop crime in the metropolitan area. Is this the best use of our money? Should we just be supplementing the police departments in Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park to do this? And if you want to have a joint powers agreement amongst your cities and the county, you know, fine. But is the state going to continue to fund this? I mean, that's a decision we'll have to make as a committee. I'm not passing judgment on it at this point.
Right.
Representative Hilstrom, you have 30 seconds to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that we're going to have budget constraints, and if you've noticed, I have a number of bills to do all sorts of things, and so whatever dollar amount we get, I am certain I can find the right way to fund these kinds of things.
Thank you, Representative Hilstrom, Sheriff, Chief, thank you for your testimony. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next up is Representative Dominguez, House File 1456.
Thank you. I think it'd be a good idea.
Representative Dominguez, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1456.
Okay, Representative Dominguez has moved House File 1456. Possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Do you want to present your bill, please?
Yes, I do, sir. This is relating to public safety, appropriating money for squad car cameras, technology, and upgrade grants. I won't take much time because, as you notice, I'm surrounded by law enforcement here, and I think they are the ones that need to describe this program, only to say that this is a program that I believe will be strong within the state of Minnesota. And as you heard earlier, some of the law enforcement things that are going on today, I think this will also help in dealing with violent crime. So again, I'm going to turn it over to first presenter is John Harrington, police chief of St. Paul.
Chief, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being back. I will be brief. I understand the committee has a lot of business today. I'm here to support this bill because I believe it really focuses on two different facets of modern police work, and it focuses on not just in St. Paul, not just in Minneapolis, but really statewide. It focuses on officer safety. The camera systems, the in-car camera systems, enhance officer safety. They provide us data for protecting the officers from civil liability. They provide us with information in the hopefully never being happening event where an officer is shot or killed or assaulted. It provides us with information that allows us to capture the bad guy. So it is a very important tool to enhance officer safety. In addition to that, it also enhances community safety and well-being. The way it does that is that we are already, the days of where racial profiling was a major topic of conversation in the cities has come back. There's probably not a community meeting I go to where it is not a topic again, whether it's the NAACP, the Native American Coalition, the Muslim American Society, CLUES, across the board, conversations about the increased attention we've paid to gangs, guns, and drugs has also brought up the topic of racial profiling. The camera system eliminates that discussion very, very rapidly. I can tell you that all it takes is simply popping in the videotape, or in this case, popping open a digital camera file to show what actually happened, and the conversation about what the officer did or didn't do simply goes away. And it enhances the credibility and the trust among the community with our police officers, and allows us to have faith and good faith with them and continue to have good partnerships and relationships with them. So I'm very, very supportive of this bill.
Thank you, Chief Harrington. Representative Dominguez, who's your next testifier?
Yes, our next speaker will be Scott. Firsthand, we have Deputy Chief here from Minneapolis, Rob Allen. Chief Dolan couldn't make it, so Rob Allen agreed to sit in for him, so I'll turn it over to him.
Deputy Chief, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm testifying on behalf of this bill. Just to point out, we do a lot of things to try and keep our officers safe, and safety for police officers involves a lot more than physical safety. The camera systems that we've been using in Minneapolis since 2003 provide the safety from allegations, which in some cases are false, but preventing officers from civil liability. I did do a one-page handout, which gives you about five examples of cases in which cameras have been useful, not only for protecting officers from civil liability, but protecting our community from fear that the police did something wrong. A lot of times there are individuals who, for whatever reasons, want to go in front of TV cameras and say that the police did something wrong, and when we have videotape to back up the fact that the officers acted appropriately, we can really calm community fears in some cases prevent lawsuits against officers. We started installing the cameras in 2003 using state funds that were allocated as a result of a racial profiling bill and grant money that was given to police agencies who agreed to collect data for racial profiling. And the logic at that time was outstanding. It basically said that if we're asking officers to collect that data, then we should have some objective recording of what the officers were experiencing at the time of the traffic stop. And the program has been very successful in doing that. Unfortunately, we used technology that was available at the time. And the technology is VHS tape. That was what was available on the state contract. And now we have six precincts and divisions storing videotapes, and we're running six individual Blockbuster stores in terms of the volume of videotape that's available. The videotapes very frequently take a long time to find the right tape because they're used over multiple shifts, and we're looking for a two-minute incident and sometimes 6 hours of videotape. The other thing is that the quality of tape degrades over time, the smallest unit, our traffic division, which is actually the smallest unit in the police department, has 10 squad cars. They have 1,700 tapes stored, and you can imagine the library process that's involved in storing that. Digital video is a necessary enhancement to recording because it allows us to more quickly search for the appropriate incident because everything is time stamped and it doesn't degrade over time. Additionally, since there are fewer moving parts, the likelihood of something being lost in the storage process is significantly lower. So this is a way to protect officers from false allegations. It's a way to reassure the public that the police officers are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
And the your final testifier?
I have two others.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the next testifier is Wayne Sutter from Brooklyn Center. He's a police chief.
Chief Sutter.
Mr. Chair, actually it's from Brooklyn Park.
From Brooklyn Park, excuse me.
I would just compliment what my colleagues have said, and I can tell you that we've had in-car video systems for over 10 years, and I know of 5 federal lawsuits that were dismissed as a result of the recordings that were made and allegations of misconduct by officers. Although they occur, they do provide us with the opportunity to have an objective review of that, and it really does become a component of risk management. I can just share with you one story. About 4 years ago, we had an allegation of racial profiling by one of our officers in our community, and a prominent Minneapolis civil rights leader came to represent the individual who was making the allegation. The captain that assisted them pulled out the tape, put the tape in the VCR in his office, played it back for both the complainant and his representative, and the representative told us it's only the second time in 25 years of being involved in civil rights advocacy that he's had a tape played for him prior to a complaint being filed, and that case was concluded. That can play out far differently. It can get into an internal investigation. Certainly it can get into a lawsuit and other litigation, and this technology does protect our police officers.
Mr. Johnson, are you next?
Yes, my final.
Mr. Johnson, if you could just be brief, we have questions. And
yes, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here on behalf of the rank-and-file police officers that are out on the streets each day. I represent Teamster Law Enforcement, which is about 1,000 police officers around the state. I represent 3,000 officers with the Peace Officers Alliance of Minnesota, and most notably amongst a lot of the committee members here, I represent the Minneapolis Police Department. How do cops feel about this bill? We like it. They like it because it's needed. And it's good that we can join with management and with the cities to all come together to speak as one before a committee. So we do ask your support for this technological upgrade. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony. Representative Biskins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this goes to the Deputy Chief of Minneapolis. Deputy Chief, besides the regular tax base, the City of Minneapolis also gets about $93 million a year in local government aid. And I know the City of Minneapolis frequently has to deal with lawsuits. I'm curious as to whether or not you have gone to the City of Minneapolis to ask for the $500,000 that would be earmarked to the city for this program, and if you have, what is the rationale for having rejected that?
Deputy Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the total cost of the program of upgrading these cameras is $1.1 million. We're asking for state aid because it was a state program that initially provided the cameras for us, and it's an upgrade to that program. In addition, as you know, the amount of local government aid that the city has received has decreased dramatically, which causes us to go to the city for additional officers and to put that burden on local property tax base. And so the funds that the city are providing us are by and large for personnel. We're looking for state and government aid for technology upgrades whenever we can.
Representative Distance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Deputy Chief, you have not asked the city at all for this proposal, because I would think a reasonable case could be made that if this technology does indeed prevent lawsuits, that any accountant would look at a quick actuarial study and say, yeah, this makes sense, $500,000 here, which is what you're asking from the state, all right, to save potentially millions in lawsuits would be a good trade-off.
Deputy Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, again, the we're asking for state aid for about half of the cost of this upgrade, and that additional half will be absorbed through city funds, and if we can get federal grant funds, federal grant funds. So.
Representative Eastland, and then Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Biskins kind of went down the line of questioning I was going to take, and I guess maybe I just ask the question a little bit differently. You talked about this, that there's some issues that that you're facing right now. It's managing these tapes and storage and people and time looking for incidences and all that sort of thing. And then there's the legal, hopefully the savings that will come, reducing the number of lawsuits, expediting cases when there's evidence out there, so lawsuits challenging in the court is just going to be dropped because the evidence is clear that it didn't happen, the accusation didn't happen. Have you done any analysis to understand what using the cameras over the past 3 years has saved the city?
Deputy Chief Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the challenge is proving a negative and proving that, that we would have lost X dollars in this case. It's very hard to prove. The other thing, frankly, is that we're spending a lot of time with being librarians of data, and that doesn't allow a lot of time to do the kind of analysis. Our focus is to keep officers on the street and doing their police work. But the real challenge for us is that it's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to prove that something didn't happen because of the presence of the cameras, although intuitively we know that.
Mr. Chair. Well, and I guess that's the point. I think intuitively, I think all, or at least I am sitting around the table hearing what you're saying about the good of the cameras. Intuitively, it's clear that the cameras have had a very positive effect, both on enforcement and an economic, very economical way to do better enforcement and do it more efficiently. And so I guess the state did pay for the cameras initially, but I guess I'm going down the same road that Representative Biskins went down. I mean, there's a significant benefit to the city that's been demonstrated by having the cameras, and it would seem like the upgrade would fall more as a responsibility on the city than on the state, seeing as it's pretty much demonstrated both in fact and intuitively that it has had some cost-effective measures that have happened. So I think, I guess that's where I'm kind of struggling here I don't live in a big city, but there's a lot of cities that would love to have cameras. And if we're going to spend more money on cameras and we know they work, maybe we should be spending money on cameras in other locations. I mean, I guess from a state perspective, that's kind of where I'm going.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that I remember when Representative Dominguez's predecessor, not the immediate one, but back to Greg Gray, and he was on the original profiling issue, and Mr. Johnson was very involved with the negotiations and everything, and that there was an awful lot that went into those negotiations on that bill, and I remember being told that this the state was going to provide these cameras as part of those negotiations for putting that bill through. So I think that we should be keeping the part of that agreement that we had. There was an awful lot that went into getting that thing together. And
on that point, Representative Liebling, I'll get back to you in a minute. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, flesh out the discussion. Was there a discussion or agreement the state would provide the cameras and then provide upgrade to the cameras and then further upgrade after that? So do you recall any of those discussions?
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, there wasn't any specific that I know of agreement as to what type of cameras or what grade of them or whether you would replace them when they needed to be. I don't think that there was. Maybe Mr. Johnson's the only one that was right in the middle of it. I don't know if he remembers. I don't think it got into actual print that I know of.
I seem to remember that. I don't remember any long-term agreement, Representative Mulry, but maybe mind is Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm very supportive of this concept. I know I'm from Rochester, and we have, I know, at least some cameras down there. And in my former life, I was a criminal defense lawyer, and I know that these have multiple benefits. And one is, as you've mentioned,
it's good for the community to have some comfort about how the police really are behaving. I think also the occasional bad actor actually behaves better when he knows the camera's on him. So I think you're actually preventing some bad incidents by having the cameras as well, both with the people that perhaps the police are encountering as well as some police officers. I do think that this creates savings for the state, not just for the city of Minneapolis, because we've heard a lot in this committee about how busy the courts are. And when you have something on tape and people can look at it, as you've mentioned in some circumstances, you know, in civil rights actions, certainly this would be the case, but also in criminal cases, where you can look at what actually happened and everybody knows what the evidence is going to be up front. Sometimes you can settle cases very quickly and keep them out of the courts, and that saves money system-wide. The one question that I have goes to the cost of these cameras. I see on the sheet here it's $4,500 per squad car. And I know that, you know, as the cost of technology keeps dropping, that just seems like a lot of money to put one digital camera in a squad. I mean, when I can go to Best Buy and buy a digital camera and stick it on my computer for, I don't know, $100, could you just somebody sort of explain why it costs so much to put a digital camera in a squad car?
Who wants to try to, Deputy Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative, but one of the reasons is that these are cameras that are moving at between 30 and 60 miles an hour on a regular basis. They have to be mounted in such a way that it's safe for the officers in the event of a collision, that they're not going to be hit by a flying squad car. So the expense of having a camera which can be safely mounted in a squad car is very expensive. The other thing is that it runs on a squad car, 12-volt DC circuitry, and not on 12 household AC circuitry, so it's more expensive components because it's not made for the general consumer market. The cost has come down. When we initially did the use the state purchasing, and this, by the way, is a state contract that we buy these cameras off. That's the cost of the contract that the state negotiated, not the city. And the cost has come down to $4,500 per camera. And if I remember correctly, it was about $7,000 per camera when we initially installed them in 2003.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Dominguez, you want to...
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one comment that Representative Eastland had mentioned that he'd like these cameras in his city, which is a small city. I'm here to inform him that his patrol officers do have cameras that are highway patrolmen. So I think he'll be safe in that instance. I would like to renew my House File 1456. I do believe this is a bill that will... initiate some good opportunities for all communities. This is a bill for the state of Minnesota, although there is a amount of appropriations for the Minneapolis area, but I do believe that this is a good opportunity that we can do some productive things out there on the highways, in the streets, in our communities, so we can have a better relationships with our constituents.
Representative Eastland, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just had one thought that was prompted in my ear here by Mr. Diebel. So you're going to, Minneapolis is requesting about $500,000, and that turns out to buy about, 100 cameras or something like that? Is that the rough equivalent?
We've got to move on here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the challenge is you need a backbone system. It's $4,500 per camera, plus you have to have a backbone system for digital storage of the images. So the first camera is about $250,000. Every subsequent camera is about $4,500.
Okay. So you can buy half that. Maybe you can buy 50 cameras and something like that. So then my question is what's going to happen? Are the cameras that you currently have in your vehicles worn out? Are they usable? Could they be distributed to other outstate police and sheriff jurisdictions so that they could continue to be used in a different venue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, the cameras themselves will be reused. It's the recording device that we're trying to replace, which is instead of going to a VHS tape, which is fragile, doesn't do well being stored outside in 40, you know, below weather and so forth, and go to a digital medium or for that.
Okay, so there is nothing that's worth salvaging out of this change out.
I can't answer that conclusively, but we'd certainly be willing to look at
okay.
it.
Okay. Representative Dominguez, Mr. Johnson, Chief, Deputy Chief. Chief, thank you for testifying.
Thank you.
We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Powell, you're next. House File 1148.
Thank you, members and Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carroll, welcome to the committee. Please present House File 1148.
I think Representative Leon's
Lily, you want to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to move the bill.
Representative Lily moves House File 1148 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. We've been hearing bills to catch them and lock them up. Here's a bill to make sure they don't get, well, not caught. Make sure they don't.
Get a buy them kind of shoes, yeah.
Make sure they don't end up doing wrong stuff so they get caught. It's pretty basic. We're asking for $500,000 to help with the after school programs, crime prevention programs. Behind me are many of the executive directors for these agencies representing the Asian communities. Many of these agencies already have money from nonprofits, from private foundations and contributions, so this would be a supplement to make sure that they could deliver these services. And earlier this year, Representative Eastman asked me about prevention intervention programs, and this is one of them. So with me are a couple testifiers, David Zander with the Asian Pacific Community Council, and Dua Lee and with Leah Lee with Southeast Asian Community Council. So we'll go directly to our testifiers.
You'd each introduce yourselves for the record when you speak.
Good morning. David Zander, Council, Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I've been working on the issue of Asian juvenile crime prevention for about 10 years, and I'm very happy to have many members of a collaborative here. If you look at the last sheet in your packet, the appendix, we have Lee Vang here from the Association for the Advancement of Hmong Women. We had Laura LeBlanc from HAP. She had to take her daughter to school. We have Mr. Ying Vang from Lao Family Community on University Avenue with me here. They will introduce themselves. We have Dua Lee and Ia Lee from SEEK, which is in North Minneapolis. Now in Joe Mallory's district, has just moved out of Hawthorne. We have Mr. Vic Chu from Vietnamese Social Services, and we have Todd, who does incredible work with the Wilder Southeast Asian Social Adjustment Program. We have had a lot of meetings. We want to keep our time here short, so we have chosen one spokesperson for this collaborative. And the main point we'd like to get over to you today is the mission, goals, objectives of this group. A little background, I was very pleased again to see Representative Stanek in his new role. We had a big problem. This money had been brought from community efforts in the early 80s to stop crime on University Avenue. I have emails from Li Pao Zhong, who was instrumental with Sheriff Fletcher on getting this funding to reduce gang violence on University Avenue. it led to a forming a collaborative, and all this is described in the notes I've made for you. We had a shock when Governor Ventura came to power. Even though he had been visiting these agencies, my phone was ringing off the hook in his first budget because he had slashed all the funding for the Asian juvenile crime prevention programs and programs like Motherly Read. We were able to get this funding reappropriated for 2 years in the administration. Senator Andy Kelly, who had originally helped get this funding as a baseline budget, it was in the Department of Human Services originally, he helped us get the funding back, but we have never managed to get it back into the baseline again, the permanent funding. All these, we don't want to talk too much about statistics or budgets. There's a lot of information we could give you, and we can just say that these agencies do their best to survive. It's been very competitive. I'm very sad to report that two of the agencies that were funded no longer exist because of funding cuts. So we've lost the Women's Association for Hmong Lao, and we've lost the Minnesota Pacific Association, and we're they're trying to survive in one way or the other. So I'd like to draw your attention to the last conclusions. The collaborative is expanding. At the State Council, we are statewide, and we serve 44 communities. Over the last few years, I've been hearing from the Korean community, and we have Reverend Park here from the Korean Adopted Ministry, and he's been talking to me about similar problems of Korean adoptees who are incarcerated or are suicidal or are in crime. So we're very pleased to have added two Korean groups to our collaborative. The main point we want to get to you is a similar mission and goals. I want to say personally, I'm very impassioned about this work. It's important to have police on the street, but it's also important to have the agency directors who are helping link with youth and families. Think back on your own life. I know at 13 and 14 years of old age in London, there were adults and peers slightly older than me that kept me on track, I'm not in a London prison. I have a PhD now in anthropology, and I can trace it to the youth programs in my life. And that's what we're talking about here in the Southeast Asian communities. So without more ado, I'd like to introduce Ia Lee, who is Youth Program Coordinator, who came up through at one of these agencies and does wonderful work with the Southeast Asian Community Council.
Sir, would you introduce yourself to the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. I coordinated four different youth programs.
Your name is again, sir?
I'm sorry?
Your name is again?
Ia Lee.
Thank you.
I coordinated four different programs over at Southeast Asian Community Council, four different youth programs. I've been a part of these youth programs for 9 years, and for the past three, I've been the coordinator. I've seen kids come and go. A lot of them have been able to keep their heads together and keep focused enough to graduate from high school, but there are others that weren't able to do that and have to come to a life of juvenile crime. Most people who work with inner city youth and students of color would agree that when you're able to sustain a strong connection and a relationship with these youth, they have a higher percentage of making the right choices. As passionate and effective as our staff and our partners may be, we do not compare to the sheer number of negative influences that are on the streets and surround these youth's everyday life. It really breaks my heart every time I hear about one of my youth who have been incarcerated or impregnated at the age of 14 and 15. And sadly, there's actually quite a few numbers that come through, too. It saddened me even more knowing that if only we had a few more resources I could exhaust in these kids, spend a little more time with them, take them to visit the state capitol a little bit more, visit fewer colleges, we might have been able to keep them away from this lifestyle and from these outcomes. The Asian community has been experiencing a steady increase in criminal activity with our juveniles for some time now. Historically, we've seen that most of our nation's gang activity happens within its new immigrant groups. Who better to address these problems than the people who know how these kids feel and can relate to what these kids might be thinking? Although actual gang activity is very similar throughout different ethnic groups, different ethnic gangs, the things they do are very similar, the deviant activity is very similar, but the motives are very culturally specific. When I say motives, I mean the pressures that a young boy or young girl might be feeling to participate in gang activity or have to elicit these gang behaviors is very specific to the cultures. It's different for the pressures they feel is different for a Hmong person, different for someone who might be Korean or Vietnamese or Lao or Cambodian. These cultural specifics, I believe, will be best dealt with people from that specific culture. Who better to understand what a child's feeling than someone, for instance, like one of my Hmong youths? I will relate to how they're feeling more than, for instance, someone who is Cambodian or Korean. Personally, I think that gang task forces in our judicial system is very effective at intervention, and they will address gang activity at a more local, state, and national level. But if we are able to prevent our youth from ever getting involved in these activities and behaviors, not only will we be saving dollars from needing these gang task forces, we will be saving the bright futures of the young youths who may become gang members. Funds being cut from such efforts will not be saving anything for anyone. If agencies do not have the proper funds to provide proper staffing so these youths can get proper services they need, we cannot prevent them from a life of crime. And the connection with these youths that is so important may never be made, let alone given the chance to be sustained. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have someone else that
I have Dora Lee, Executive Director of SEEK, in case we have any questions around these programs. But we're open to questions.
I'm just curious about how the money will get distributed. There's 12 programs that are part of the collaborative, and so who oversees the money? And you really don't have a budget outlined here, but I'm just curious how this would work.
Mr. Chair, representatives, when we reappropriated the money, it was moved over to the Department of Public Safety, and they controlled the contracts. The contracts were issued, very strict evaluation methods. So we are anticipating that there would be a request for proposals from the agencies serving Asian youth. It would go through Department of Public Safety.
So that each program would then apply for grant money? Is that?
I'm anticipating that there would be something on the order of $33,000 to $50,000 for the agencies selected, which would at least allow them to have one staff person working on this.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was similar to that. Explain a little bit about the Asian Pacific Council. Who is that organization, and how do they function?
We're part of state government. We were presenting a few days ago. Our executive director, Eileen He, is here. There are four state councils, diversity councils. We were formed in 1985. To advise the governor and legislators on issues, and also to help, which is what we're doing today, help the communities access you, have a voice in policy issues and access funding. So we are a small state agency. We are over in Centennial. I'm very pleased to have walked through the tunnel to get here this morning.
I'm just reading the statute that is referenced here about the Asian Juvenile Crime Prevention. It says the commissioner and consultant in consultation with the Asian Pacific Council. The Asian Pacific Council will play a significant role in determining who the grantees are.
Mr. Zand.
We hope, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's what happened in the past. We had very good links with the Assistant Commissioner. I already placed calls to the Office of Juvenile under Department of Public Safety, Jerry Bouvet, alerting her that we are trying to get this funding and to start the process of how we will look at contracts and run this money.
One final.
Senator Eastland.
What, I mean, currently, how many grants are there that you are currently, that you've given that are currently out there? Or what's kind of been the yeah. granting experience over the past few years?
Mr. Zander.
I'll call on Executive Director to share his experience. My experience is that the money was lost. The money for these programs was lost, so that these programs have had to compete very small grant writers with larger entities. I have not been involved with any money that has come to these agencies. It was lost. It was cut, and now we are trying to get that money reappropriated expressly for this Asian juvenile gang prevention issue. But let me ask Mr. Dua Lee to give his experience of trying to run the program having lost the funding.
Dua Lee.
Yes. My name is Dua Lee. I'm the Executive Director of Southeast Asian Community Council. And for the past few years that since the budget's been cut, a lot of our agencies been working extremely hard trying to cut some or trying to get some of the funding from different programs, bits and pieces from here and there, to just making sure that our youth program, because they're a part of our community, are operating appropriately, or operating so there weren't much of the youth out in the street. And this request that we're asking right now will be very supportive and help off our different programs that we're going to be running. So for the past few years that since the budget been cut, we've been pretty much up in limbo. Mainly a little bit of our funding are from private foundations, and usually if it's out there, we don't have much funding from there. It's just like a couple of thousand here and there. A lot of them would come from the summer programs, and some are from, if we have any contract with the schools for after school activities through our ALC grants, those are part of the grants that we're getting. So there isn't any really definite permanent funding that are going mainly towards this crime prevention or intervention. And so those are the things that I've been suffering with the organization, and also with the different organizations in the Asian community. Those are the things that I just want to share with all of you guys.
Representative Eastland. Just one clarifying comment. Well, one of the other approved uses of the grant funds are to use them as match dollars for federal. How much of that kind of revenue are you seeking or is available so this money could be used as a match and leveraged against additional dollars?
Mr. Lee.
Okay. We're seeking for the amount that we're requesting here, because like I said earlier, our funding now, they are very minimal, and we're just cutting our staff time from other different programs to make sure that they run our programs are running. So this will actually be making about a 3/4 of a staff to help run a program. So that's our request for the funding.
Representative Zellers, Haas, and Coles are in line here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and your question earlier prompted my this cross-pollination from committees. Representative Bingham and I are on Chair Kahn's committee, and we had a report on grants, the Office of Legislative Auditor, and how grants are appropriated and the follow-back with how the money is being spent in some cases, mostly in the healthcare field, but in some cases we weren't seeing any documentation or money being spent, and kind of in some cases even a paper trail. And this is maybe for Mr. Zander or for Mr. Lee, as far as your grants and how you report use of those grants. Can you give us a little assurance that you are already reporting? I know there's probably going to be legislation coming out of here this year that's going to require that, so if you're ahead of the curve, we always appreciate hearing that, but if nothing else, it's a heads up that if you're not, we're going to be changing the way things are done around here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is in the Senate. Senator Higgins authored this bill, and this is a major concern. This is why we are establishing, out of the leading agencies, a collaborative. This grant will help get matching funds. It will help these small agencies compete. They do document very strictly. I mean, they get grants on all kinds of issues. Some members of this collaborative, we're working on problem gambling. We're also working on issues like sexual trafficking. So what I've noticed over the years, for example, Mr. Cao Insa-Siengme is here, excellent agency in North Minneapolis. I say, Mr. Cao Insa-Siengme, there's a grant. Can you apply for it? And he said, oh, David, I'm so busy having to do all the evaluations, all the monthly reports. So it is extremely difficult for these very small-scale agencies. We have Reverend Park here, who is like a one-person agency. So it is extremely heavy. So having a collaborative, we had a lot of group brainstorming, and they support each other, they collaborate wherever possible. I mentioned in here that Wilder has worked with Lao Family, has worked with the United Cambodian on some excellent work with families. Some of that funding was cut. So we assure you that this collaborative will be the best practices, will be the best leaders from the agencies in the state of Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, yesterday you had in your packet a document from OJP and how they sort of manage the smaller grants and how they assure accountability and site visits and things like that. So if you haven't had a chance to review that, you might want to take a look. And we can also have them come back if you would like, because we are, this is an ongoing issue about ensuring that we have accountability here. Representative Haas is next.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have just a question which I'm very curious about. In not-so-past lives, I coached a couple Asian American soccer teams, both in youth and adults. One you may even remember because they actually beat people, and they were called the Elephants, and we had a red T-shirt with a white sacred elephants on the shirt. They were very hard to hang on to. If anybody set one down on the bench, we then would be short one shirt. In that process, which was an informal process because this was just put together in any way we could, we had about 85% Asian American and about 15% coming from other groups. Do you hold your programs entirely Asian American, or are they allowed, the kids in the neighborhood, the youth in the neighborhood, are they allowed to participate within your group, and how does that work for you?
Mr. Zander.
Mr. Chair, Representative, agencies, it's been very different answer according to each one. Many agencies that I go to now, I walk in and it's like being in a Somali agency. For example, CAPI on West Lake Street, Hmong American Partnership in the citizenship classes in the ELL, you will see many Africans. I think sometimes the names need to change, like Center for Asian Pacific Islanders needs to be Center for Refugee Immigrants. But some of these programs are culturally specific. As you were talking about the soccer teams and the elephant, I was thinking of Mr. Cao Insa-Siengme, that is his team, is here. Their effort, they have moved out of leasing a building to owning their own building on West Broadway. If you walk in there, you will find it filled with trophies. And it was very interesting with the voter registration. Mr. Cao insisting we're going around all these teams trying to make sure that citizens register to vote. But I think there is a little bit of I mean, the programs are open, they're among working with Lao, but they tend to be culturally specific. One of the side issues I thought we might be getting to is their lack of access to the soccer space. We were able to help them get extra space on Theodore Worth Parkway, and it needs that kind of intervention. Often, you know, the little league teams and the very organized mainstream teams control all the access to the fields. But, Joy, do you want to add anything to that about how the groups coming in?
Mr. Lee. One of the things that, to add to this is that we, all these organizations that are on this list, we've been working together for the past 20 years. And to answer your question is that we are culture-specific requesting this funding for the Asian communities. However, let's say my organizations and many others, we're not closing the doors to other ethnic groups. If Somalis or any other Caucasians or African Americans that comes through, we will also support them as well if they are willing to go according to what our culture specifically are gearing towards in helping the community. Because again, Zia mentioned earlier that different nationality have different ways of treating or working with their youth, and even though we're all, you know, quote unquote look similar, we have all different way and background, different culture of working with our community. So just want to add that.
Representative,
please, Mr. Chair.
Representative,
just one comment, more comment. They also play a game called Tagra or Ratan, which you cannot be beaten at. So I.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, do any of your programs that you provide, I understand that most of the individuals, or I assume most of the individuals that you're serving tend to at least early on start out as low-income individuals, but do any of the programs that you provide, do you charge fees either on a sliding scale, or is everything done without regard to any income of the participant or the participant's family?
Mr. Lee.
Honestly, 100% of our communities that we serve are low income. And as far as my organizations and many that I know of, there isn't any charge here from any of the community members. Because definitely for sure, we know that they can't afford to even pay like a dollar or 50 cents or so. And in the past, I know that in this modernization of this country, we like to see if they have some input into it. We tried, and as soon as you try, kids are not coming in, parents are not getting involved, and that's something that we realize that the communities are not to the level where we're expected to be. So that's to answer your questions. No.
Thanks.
Representative Dominguez, and then we're gonna wrap up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a past executive director of a nonprofit and working with the Southeast Asian Pacific Islanders, which is this group, I had the opportunity to work with their group. I ran a Latino organization, and we worked together quite well. The programs were developed to interact with amongst each other, and I really appreciate them for being here. A lot of them are in my district. But also, we need to stop and think about this is a population that is growing. This is a population that came to the United States and are seeking out for help to be productive citizens. And I think this is one of the ways that they have come to the Capitol to say, we have problems within our community and we want to solve those problems. And one of the things is that they're trying to solve these problems with the gang prevention. And it's going strong, and it's rapidly growing strong within our community, especially over on the north side. And I think we need to do something about it. I have worked with them in the past because we had gangs fighting against Latino gangs and Asian gangs, African American gangs, and it is a strong thing that we need to work on because kids are killing kids over there. And I do support that this program. I do support the effort of them trying to come forward. But this is not a city issue. It's a statewide issue through the whole state of Minnesota. as Representative Haas mentioned, he coached out in St. Cloud, and he knows what goes on out there, and I think we all have those problems in our community. And again, thank you for coming forward, and I do support this effort.
Yes, Mr. Chair, very briefly, I just wanted to point out that they don't have a lot of extra funds. Kyle's and Syndromized organization went into an empty funeral home, and Dua's just went into an old pizza parlor I went to, used to go to. But I think that it's important to, we're doing an awful lot for veterans here this year and last year, and I think that for instance, Kyle, I know, was the leader of a commander of the Laotian forces that were fighting alongside ours and saved a lot of people. And both the Lao and the Hmong were fighting along our alongside our veterans. And I think we have to remember that when we're doing so much for our veterans, and they were there saving our veterans.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Any final comments, Representative Tao?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Tao, for your testimony, and to all of you for coming. We will lay House File 1148 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. There's no other discussion or questions. This meeting's adjourned.